I'm Sharon Martin, the narrator and producer of Snapped. For the past 10 years, we've profiled nearly 300 cases of women accused of murder. And even after all those episodes, some cases still make me ask, why would she do that? What was she thinking? Cheryl Kunkel is one of those cases.
Thank you for using Securus. You may start the conversation now.
Hi, Cheryl. It's Sharon.
Hi, Sharon.
And unfortunately, we weren't able to interview Cheryl for the show, but I was able to talk to her by phone.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
These are prison calls, so they're recorded and often interrupted, but it's interesting to hear her perspective on her own case.
I am innocent of all charges that I've been brought against me.
I suppose that's not surprising to hear from someone serving a life sentence, but let's start with why Cheryl is there in the first place, the murder of her ex-boyfriend. Ben Amato was a well-liked local volunteer firefighter in Chestnut Hill Township.
He was always there. If something happened, he would always be the first one to volunteer to come and help somebody. Really nice guy.
That's Debbie York, a retired local judge. No one had seen Ben for a few days, and there was some concern. And on November 16th, they found him at the bottom of his basement steps.
Because of the evidence at the scene, they realized that it wasn't an accident, it wasn't a suicide, that it was a murder.
So police were looking for a suspect, and Ben's stepdaughter, Erin Stenger, knew exactly where to start.
I went to the cops as soon as I figured it out that he was murdered, and I said, you need to go call Cheryl Kunkel. You need to go talk to her.
Cheryl, how did you meet Ben?
He was a friend of my father's for quite some time, and I had purchased a home. And, I had called him to give me an estimate on a garage for my house. And we were friends for a while, and we just started dating. That's how it went.
That was around 1998. Ben was 48, Cheryl was 29. She was a single mother with an 11-year-old son named Greg, and she was running her own business.
It was a seal coating business that I started. It's for blacktop seal coating. I loved it. I mean, I loved being self-employed as well, but it was a good business.
But you'd also studied to be a police officer?
This is something I always had an interest in because I didn't have armed forces or... You know, it was just hard to land a position.
So she was dating Ben, who's nearly 20 years her senior, and according to Ben's stepdaughter, Peggy Bowman, they seem to have a lot in common.
Ben and Sherry liked to do a lot of things, like outdoors. They did snowmobiling, ATVs, boating, anything that, you know, you could do outside, they did.
They dated for 7 or 8 months and broke up, but by then, Cheryl was pregnant, a situation Ben wasn't initially thrilled about. Here's his stepdaughter, Erin.
He was very devastated over this situation because I think that he wanted her gone, and her becoming pregnant, he realized that he stuck with her.
What followed was a court battle over the little boy and two very different accounts. Judge Debbie York again.
I think she planned on raising the little boy alone. I think she didn't want to share him with anybody. I think she thought that her way was the best way.
So you guys were in court over the issue of visitation. Who initiated that?
Well, all along I was telling Ben to take me to court so that way we would have, you know, visitation, you know, not see him when you felt like, you know what I mean? Because that's what my oldest son had.
Ben's family says she was fighting visitation, and that's why they were in court over the issue of custody.
Nobody's ever mentioned any custody as far as, child custody. I had already had child custody of my son.
Whatever the case, Cheryl did take Ben to court over a harassment claim after their breakup, which is how she ended up in front of Judge York.
It seemed like Cheryl felt if she got a guilty verdict against Ben in the harassment case, that she would be looked at in a better light in front of the judge in family court.
But it didn't work out that way.
I said to Cheryl, you need better evidence. Just because he drives by your house doesn't mean that he's stalking you. She stood up. She said, what do I have to do? Do I have to effing kill him to get him to leave me alone?
5 months later, Ben was dead.
As soon as I heard he was dead, I remembered she made the statement, and I immediately called the police. So it certainly made an impression on my mind.
It made an impression on investigator Sean Williams, too.
Cheryl was looking better and better as a suspect to be the one that killed Ben Amato in this case.
And remember, Cheryl ran a paving business, trained to be a police officer, was described as very physically fit. Maybe the kind of woman capable of beating a man to death.
Cheryl Kunkel could definitely take care of herself if she was confronted by someone. She was considered a tough individual. And she was someone that you wouldn't want to confront just by the way she carried herself. She was considered intimidating.
Cheryl, what did you think when you heard about Ben's death?
When I first found out, I thought he committed suicide. For, you know, he finally, you know, pulled that off, because I know he's tried to do that before. But again, that's because when the police came to my home to tell me that Ben had passed away, that's all they asked me about. That's all they questioned me about was his suicide attempts and my relationship with him.
And then police came back with a search warrant.
So at that point, I knew then that I was a suspect. And the questions, they asked me a few questions while they're in my home. There were several police in my house.
Though Cheryl says she never made that statement that Judge York reported to the police.
She told the police that I threatened Ben in her courtroom and that I had stated, what do I have to do to kill him to get him to leave me alone?
But she says there was no question that police suspected her in Ben's death.
He asked me if I killed Ben. I said no. And then he said, well, he asked me if I murdered Ben. And then he said, well, did you accidentally kill him? Was it like a domestic dispute or something? I think that's what he said. And I said, no. You can, you know, when you're being asked these questions, you automatically assume, you can assume right then and there that's what you're being accused of. You know what I mean? It's common sense.
The search didn't turn up anything, and despite their suspicions, police didn't have enough to arrest Cheryl. And here's where things get interesting. In August of 2001, that's after the harassment case in Judge York's courtroom and 3 months before Ben's murder, Cheryl had filed a police report. Cheryl, we were talking about April and the burglary. What happened there?
When she robbed my house, she stole a safe from my house that contained $8,000. I called the police and they responded.
Cheryl says she knew that it was April and that she demanded her money back.
I threatened to press charges against her. And she said, that's when she said to me, I believe it was his idea to say it, because she said, I'm gonna say that you paid me to hurt Ben. And I immediately just like shrugged that off, like ignored it.
But then her boyfriend, Nate, said something similar.
Word for word, he said that I'm the guy you hired to hurt your son's father. I guess he just wanted me to drop charges on April. This was all a threat that turned into something so much bigger.
So that was in August. In November, Ben was murdered, and according to Cheryl, April's name came up while she was being questioned by police, and she realized that the threat she claims April and Nate made to her would probably sound pretty incriminating.
I knew that they only said it to try to get me to drop the charge or not pursue a charge.
So she took matters into her own hands. Tell me what you were trying to achieve with the tapes. I'm just curious about your logic.
Why I recorded her? Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Okay. Well, it was about a month after Ben had died, or a month after the search warrant, I recorded April. I didn't understand why April's name was mentioned during my search warrant.
For some reason, your name came up. It said something like, what do you think, April did it?
Why did they ask me that? Why did they ask you that?
Well, that's why I'm here. I want to know, did you ever say anything about me or anything to anybody that I know, or family members or anybody?
So all I ever said was, well, you know what I said. I never told anybody else this, but
I asked you if you were going to press charges against me, and you said yeah. Do you remember when I asked you to go to the, when you asked me to go to the visits with you at the park?
Yeah.
Well, I used it to my advantage, and that's why I said to you, I'm going to tell them that you gave the money to Hart Benn in court.
To me, this is interesting because it's very unusual for a suspect in a murder case to stage their own investigation and secretly record conversations. So your goal with recording her was to get her to admit that she did it as a sort of threat to keep you from prosecuting her for the theft?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's all.
Cheryl even explains it to April on the tape.
I don't want you to worry about it. It's just for my protection because something was made out of what you had said.
I can't believe you're a murder suspect.
Well, obviously I am because they were in my house searching, took my cars.
But apparently Cheryl wanted more from April. She had questions about Nate and what he might say. And a month later, she used the tape recorder again.
I went back a second time. I was trying to get her to make any kind of statements. You know, she didn't know I was recording her. But the first one she did, she had no idea. Simple fact, too, that how the boyfriend made that statement to me and how April had said it to me, it was a little different. But she claims that she meant hurting him in court.
And since Cheryl was hiding the tape recorder, this tape's a little harder to understand.
Because the more I think about what he said to me, and they don't understand why, because I haven't got a chance to tell them. I didn't even realize that they even knew about it. They don't understand why it was said. Well, he knows you made a threat to me about hurting Ben in court. He knows that.
Cheryl's asking if Nate could have twisted their threat into something else to get himself out of trouble.
He wouldn't twist it for his benefit.
No.
Because you say to me, I'm going to tell him that I had paid you, gave you that money, but you didn't rip me out. I'm going to tell him that you gave me the money to hurt Ben in court. Well, if I needed your testimony.
Mm-hmm.
He knew about that. You must have told him. Somebody's leaving out hurting him in court.
That's Cheryl repeating her point. Somebody is leaving out hurting Ben in court. She wants April to say the threat was about giving testimony, not hiring a hit.
Think about it, April.
Yeah.
That don't sound good. Hurt him.
Yeah.
When I told my lawyer about the recordings, he asked me to send them to him, and he had those recordings in his possession for years.
Meanwhile, investigator Sean Williams had found that initial burglary report. And to him, the fact that Cheryl had dropped the charges against April was a red flag.
I wanted to know more about this burglary because there was a large sum of money taken from Cheryl's house. And as you read to the end of the report, all of a sudden it ends and she doesn't want anything done. Seemed very odd to me.
So investigator Williams talked to Nate, April's boyfriend, who was in jail on an unrelated matter.
We had made the statement to him, you know why we're here? And the next thing out of his mouth was, yeah, you're here about us getting paid by that lady to kill that dude.
Nate hadn't gone through with the hit. Instead, he and April say they stole more money from Cheryl and then threatened to reveal her murder for hire plot if she pressed charges. And when investigator Williams talked to April, she told him about that taped conversation.
It sounded extremely scripted. Exactly the way April described it would. She had told us that Cheryl had brought the tape recorder, put it right out in the middle of the table, and basically had a script written down. This is what we're going to talk about. Let's get ready. Now I'm going to tape it. Here we go. It was almost unbelievable that someone would take those lengths to record somebody and go through that effort just to cover themselves up. But Cheryl was very concerned about April and Nate.
In other words, to him it sounded more like after committing the murder herself, Cheryl needed to find a way to tie up the loose end of April and Nate and the attempted murder for hire. At this point, a few months after Ben's murder, Cheryl was under investigation. She knew she was a suspect. She knew about the claims that she'd made threats and tried to hire a hitman. But there's something else that's bothering her.
I felt like I was under investigation because of April.
I didn't understand at that point why they were in my home, you know, why Debbie had said the things that she said, you know, and, you know, I think my only concern at that point was my relationship with Marty.
Marty was Cheryl's boyfriend, and he was also a local cop. He had filed the initial burglary report against April for Cheryl, and once Ben's murder investigation started, he was advised to cut off contact with Cheryl.
The last thing he said to me was he'll be back when the investigation blew over. You know, I didn't handle it too well. It was like my life was being turned upside down. From the day of the search warrant, I wasn't allowed to speak to him or call him, even though I tried. God knows that.
It's the most emotional Cheryl sounded during her phone calls with me up to that point, and I was a little surprised by it. She says she'd been dating him for about a year, and then he was gone when things were at their worst for her. But she was about to have a much bigger problem.
I was charged and arrested for solicitation of homicide in 2003, July of 2003.
Cheryl was arrested not for murder, but for solicitation, basically trying to hire a hitman. Journalist Kevin Ammerman explains.
They didn't have enough at that time to actually charge her with the murder. They could only say that we're charging you with trying to hire somebody to commit the murder. But I think the confusing part was, but that guy that was hired to kill Benjamin Amato was in jail at the time, so on like an assault charge. So there's no way that he could have done it.
But it was all the police had until May of 2004. This is where the case takes a shocking turn. Kevin Ammerman again.
Kristen Fisher is found dead. She's found strangled in the garage. And there's a noose around her neck. And authorities said it was staged. It was made to look like she hanged herself.
Kristen was 17. Her mother found her. She also found Kristen's 7-month-old baby drowned in a bathtub.
It was absolutely unbelievable. It's just impossible to believe that anybody would do something like that, not only to Kristen, but to a young, innocent baby like that.
That's Kristen's grandmother, Kathleen Kupis. She explains that Kristen told her mother she was expecting a visit from the baby's father, Greg Rowe.
Kristen had told her earlier that Greg Rowe was going to come and visit her and the baby because he had a surprise for them. And my daughter told her, don't let him in. So when she called on the phone and she said to Kristen, Greg's not there, is he? Don't let him in when he comes. And Kristen says to her, Mom, he's here already. He's in the house. And that was the last she talked to Kristen.
Greg was Cheryl Kunkel's 18-year-old son, and he was now the prime suspect in a horrifying double murder. And to Ben Amato's stepdaughter, Erin, the parallels with her father's case were terrifying.
My dad's murder was on the night before his custody hearing. Greg murdered his girlfriend the night before the child support hearing.
Cheryl, how did you feel when you heard the accusations against Greg?
I just knew that my son could not have possibly done that and what he was being accused of. And I didn't feel like he had any reason to. He never complained about the woman he's accused of killing, let alone the child that also was murdered.
Cheryl was out on bond for the solicitation charge when the police arrived at her home. Kevin Ammerman explains what happened next.
And they tell her, don't go in your garage, because they're about to serve a search warrant on that car, on Gregory Rowe's car, which is in the garage.
But Cheryl admits she didn't listen.
I went into the car and took the cell phone charger and the CD case out of the car, and the officer arrested me at that point for handcuffs on me. And I handed him what I had taken and the cell phone charger and the CD case. And it just laid there. He wasn't interested. So did I know I was tampering with anything? No. And not only that, there was no search warrant. I felt I had every right to go in the vehicle.
She was arrested for violating her bond, and while she was in jail, her son Greg was arrested for the murders of his ex-girlfriend and their baby.
I was still grasping what I was going through, and, you know, being in jail, you're helpless.
You have 1 minute left.
you can't do anything to help your child.
Facing double murder charges and a possible death penalty, Greg eventually gave Investigator Williams a statement about the murder of Ben Amato.
I had several interviews with him where he admitted that, yes, I drove my mom to Ben Amato's house. Yes, my mom left the car for some time. I was only 15, but she wanted me to drive the vehicle. A few hours passed, and then she came back to the vehicle, and she was very upset. And he basically drove away from the scene of Ben Amato's house.
It was the break police needed in the case against Cheryl. On November 3rd, 2005, 4 years after Ben Amato's death, she was officially charged with his murder, and her son's statement was the key evidence against her. As a mother, when you heard that, what was your reaction to that?
I think I was in disbelief until the day I went to trial. I wasn't sure how he could have made those kind of statements or why, except the fact that he was accused of the same type of crime himself. I'm sure the kid was scared.
And she was still in disbelief when he testified against her at her trial in February of 2007.
I don't think it all hit me until I was sitting in that courtroom. You know, I really didn't know how to handle the fact that it was my son, my own son. I knew there had to be a reason he was making the statements that he made. I knew that it had to have something to do with the way he was interrogated or something. You know, I didn't know yet just what he was saying either until I sat in that courtroom. So, yeah, it was overwhelming.
But Greg wasn't the only witness against her. Marty, the police officer she'd been dating, testified as well. When the investigation began, Marty told Sean Williams that Cheryl couldn't have been involved.
He described Cheryl Kunkel as a very calm, nice person, a person that spoke very highly of Ben Amato and never said anything insulting about him, a person that had never spoken about a custody issue with him, about Ben Amato and her frustration. That bothered me after the interview to the point where it always stuck in the back of my head as a problem.
But after Greg had made statements against his mother, Williams went back to Marty, and this time he told a different story.
Now, he's a sworn police officer. He knows she's suspect in this. You know, her former boyfriend was just murdered. And ultimately, he goes up to her, puts his hand on her shoulder and says, "What's wrong, Cheryl?" And Cheryl had disclosed to him that we fought all the way down the steps, meaning her and Ben Amato. She was crying. And he said it was an eerie moment that actually he felt like ice went right through his veins.
So in court, Marty told the jury that Cheryl had confessed to killing Ben Amato.
This guy, he had lied to us initially and wasn't forthcoming with the information about her admission to him. That was key. This is a guy that was a police officer for 19 years that was essentially knew the outcome was going to be, my career is over. I can't be a police officer anymore. That was big for the jury to hear.
Cheryl said she was blindsided by his testimony.
Marty suddenly had something to say. But then at the end of the trial, he had told the news reporters that he didn't think I did it, but I do now. And I believe that's not a statement you would make if somebody made any kind of incriminating statements to you.
She denies making any confession to Marty and describes their last conversation this way.
He said he would be back when your investigation blew over, but he never came back. Yeah, it was devastating. That's all I can say. I mean, to this day, he doesn't know I was crazy about him, but I never had a chance to tell him. You know, I never did. He never told me how he felt either, and it's probably because, you know, he was married.
Married. I knew about Marty's role in the case and his role in the trial, but given the way she talked about him, I didn't register that he was married until Cheryl said it. Last time we talked, you said you had dated for a year. He was married during that time?
Yes. Yeah, he was I guess trying to get separated, but he didn't want to, you know, he didn't want to put his wife out in the street or anything. She didn't have any place to go. Yeah, it was, it just happened that way. I don't try to date married men. You know, I think it was hard for both of us. It was hard to see each other. It was hard to spend time together. It was just hard. It was not something I'd ever thought I would do, is date a married man.
It didn't work out well for Marty either. Aaron Stenger explains it best.
He lost everything. He lost his wife. He lost his pension. He lost his job. She ruined his life as well.
Her son and her lover testified against her. Another friend testified that she confessed to him as well and even asked him to help her burn the murder weapon, a bat. Ben's custody lawyer testified that Ben said he was afraid of Cheryl and that she had left him threatening messages. It was a lot of circumstantial evidence. Judge Debbie York.
A circumstantial case is always difficult for the prosecution, but there was so much circumstantial evidence that it was a good case against Cheryl. The best thing going for her is the cast of characters all weren't upstanding members of the community. But even with that being said, there were so many of them and they had no reason to lie.
So Cheryl was probably the only one surprised when the jury returned a verdict of guilty. How did you feel when you heard the verdict?
I was devastated. I can't even describe it. I can't put it into words. You don't think that the jury is going to find you guilty either. You know, you're not thinking that. You know, you just think that it's your lawyer's going to defend you and he's going to present all this stuff.
Cheryl says her defense was inadequate, but she also describes the prosecution's case this way.
This whole case was lies from the beginning, from probable cause to the end.
She disputes nearly every piece of evidence, arguing that she never made any threats against Ben and that he wasn't afraid of her at all.
He also had no problem following me. So if that's fear, I don't understand why the police didn't see that, you know?
She also questions the expert testimony about the blood evidence around Ben's body and how her defense handled it. She brought it up several times during our calls.
For 3 days, there was no documents of any blood spatter. So why nobody would have noticed at that point for 3 days is unexplainable.
But just from looking at the crime scene photos, it's apparent someone else was there. I mean, there are footprints in the blood. You know, we've seen the photos of that.
I understand that. But what you need to understand as well is it impact spatter or is it all expirated spatter from the nose or the mouth? See, that's the question. And that's something I wasn't able to defend. As far as having a defense expert.
It's obvious she spent the years since her conviction poring over every detail of the case against her, trying to pick it apart to prove her point. Cheryl, what do you think happened to Ben that night?
I'm unsure if the man was even murdered or if he really did die of an unprotected fall. I don't know what to make of it because I analyze a lot of the things that the police said to me and asked me. So I really don't know what to think. I really don't believe that anybody was out to murder the man. I really don't.
And what about the witnesses against her? Greg, her son, Marty, her ex-boyfriend. Why would they all say she's confessed? What you're saying is that their testimony is all untrue, but why would they all tell the same story? Wouldn't that amount to a conspiracy?
Well, when you conspire, to me, that means the other person, everybody knew. So I don't know if I would call it a conspiracy. I do believe they were convinced. I believe everybody was convinced that I murdered Ben for the simple fact that I was accused of threatening Ben and in a courtroom. I was accused of leaving threatening messages on his answering machine. This was all in the newspapers. I was arrested and accused of soliciting
So who's not going to believe that I murdered Ben?
She was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole, and Cheryl's new attorney, Axel Jones, has filed an appeal on her behalf.
The focus of the appellate issues that we filed in this case are mostly of a procedural nature regarding some evidentiary issues and certain evidentiary concerns that should or should not have come into trial in the first place.
Listening to Cheryl talk about her case, it's clear she believes she was wrongfully convicted. But in order to believe her, you have to believe that everyone else is lying. And convincing the appeals court that the case against her is tainted is a tall order. Her best hope, according to her attorney, is getting some piece of that evidence excluded.
If Cheryl's successful in her appeal to the Supreme Court here, then certain statements that she may have made to third parties, including the statements at the custody conference, would not be admitted in a retrial. And without those statements, I think the Commonwealth would have a very difficult time proving the motive or intent of Ms. Kunkel to commit these crimes.
For Cheryl, the hope of an appeal is all that keeps her going.
The only thing I could think of afterwards is, okay, this will be over in a couple years. It'll take for the higher courts. That's how I lived each day, that the higher courts would see just what happened here and overturn it. I never thought it would take 8 years, but I know for some people it takes a lot longer.
For Ben Amato's friends and family, Cheryl's exactly where she belongs. And according to journalist Kevin Ammerman, some of them believe that she not only committed murder, she set the stage for her son to commit murder as well.
I mean, look at the damage she created. Look what Gregory Rowe became because of what Cheryl Kunkel had done. You know, you can argue that he did what he was taught to do. He murdered somebody when he had a problem because that's what his mother taught him to do.
As for her son with Ben, he's a teenager now, living with Cheryl's family, but she has no contact with him.
It was very, very hard. It still hurts every day. Yeah, I just want to hear his voice, and I don't even have a picture of him, you know. It was very painful for about 4 years, and I couldn't function here and focus on, you know, the pain. And the only way I could deal with it was to suppress it.
Before we wrapped up our final call, I asked Cheryl if she's thought about what happens when her appeals are exhausted. Cheryl, what happens if your appeals aren't successful?
Oh, I don't even... You can't even ask me that question because I don't even want to entertain that, you know, and I don't even want to think about it. I've always just kept the faith, and I'm confident that one day it's going to happen for me. That's, you know, the what ifs are just not. I can't answer that.
This podcast was produced by Deborah Allen, Sharon Martin, Maggie Sharble, Madeline McAdams, and the Snapped production team. Edited by Matt Brewster and Sarah Longnecker, mixed by Dylan Turflinger, and produced for Oxygen by Jupiter Entertainment.